based on a consumer demand. But listen, we're an ad-funded business, and advertising does not cover all of our activities, even before coronavirus. So we had a plan to create it as a service, because when people are asking for something, it's not, you know, it wasn't just a byproduct, it is a service they were asking for, that we needed to just put a very reasonable subscription price on it.
Welcome back to Media Voices, everybody. We are the Media Focus podcast that looks at all the news and the views from around the media world every single week. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
So that extract was from our interview with Ella Dolphin, who is the CEO of The Stylist Group. So we talked about how they managed an acceleration in their plan to support digital subscriptions, what changes the brand has seen since shifting the focus entirely from shortlist to stylist, and what she's doing to get stylists ready for the next 5 years.
But before then, we're going to be leading with our news roundup. And the theme this time is, well, it's data. And whichever one of you chose the title, See You Later, Data Haters, you should be ashamed of yourself.
I think we know it was you, Chris.
And anyway, the lead story is that the ABC's, the Audit Bureau of Circulation, they're going to stop issuing the monthly public report of print newspaper circulations after 33 years. So this is, I mean, we foresaw this coming a couple of months ago when the Telegraph pulled out. They said that they were no longer going to share their print circulations with the ABCs. But now, after, what was it, News UK pulled their titles out, the ABCs have decided that no, circulation data must instead be secret.
What was really weird about the ABC story around this, or the story that the ABC was trying to tell, was that not publishing the numbers addresses publisher concerns that every time these numbers were out, there was this kind of rush to report a negative narrative. And I was like, well, guys,
yeah,
this is a negative narrative. It doesn't matter how you look at it.
Right, when the Titanic was going down, did they prevent the crewmen from telling people how far the water had progressed? Or was it just like, get the f*** on the lifeboats?
That was the point.
Because that's what this is. People know.
Is this a Titanic equivalent of putting a string quartet on the deck?
That was more noble than this. Playing Near Oh My God to Thee is much more noble than this idea that if we all just bury our head in the sand, then there's no problem. But that narrative isn't going to go away.
I don't think that's the point for the publishers. I think ABC's maybe just trying to predict themselves a little bit longer. But News UK is focusing on the PAMCO numbers, which is this reach, measure of reach. And that, you know, that makes sense, I guess.
You know, it does.
You've got print and digital reach and it's all together.
Well, we said that when the Telegraph pulled out. We said that it's no longer, the print circulations do not tell the whole story.
But it's still weird to say, we've got these numbers, but you can't see them. It's just like, what the
Yeah, exactly. And the problem with the PAMCO data as well is it relies on people's self-reporting.
Lies, damn lies and data.
I just think the worst part of this is, I can't remember who I saw saying this on Twitter, it is hypocritical for an industry that builds its fortune on shining light on other industries and reporting accurately to suddenly say, no, we're making this data secret.
I suppose the ABC doesn't really have a huge amount of choice, does it? Because if it didn't make this move, more and more people would have left, and at that point it becomes a completely pointless exercise.
Yeah, I think the papers are driving this. I think this is why these stories are linked together, isn't it? Part of this is about getting the right data for advertisers. It's not just about scale. It's not just about reach. It's about knowing who these people are, what they're reading, and why that makes them a good target for advertising, if that's why you need these numbers.
Peter, can you please read your tweet out on this? Because it was my favourite thing I read all week.
Well, you know, to me, making the numbers secret now seems like a horseless stable door closing situation. But tune in next quarter for positive narratives of continued circulation decline. I don't know. These stories, this is not a positive story in any way.
No.
Some of the other data stories that are going on at the moment, I think, are more positive.
Obfuscation is never a positive story, really, is it?
No.
And particularly for an industry that harps on about the complete opacity of the digital advertising ecosystem, to suddenly go, you know what, let's lean into that, but for print instead.
you know, that's why people listen to this podcast. For phrases like you just said, the opacity of whatever it was. That was a great phrase.
Thanks.
We should get that in a jingle.
And actually, speaking of advertising data online, the NYT is phasing out all third-party advertising data. So it's going to aim to stop using all third-party data to target ads by 2021. Peter, why is it doing this?
Well, there's a couple of reasons they're doing it. One is because the browser guys are removing cookies anyway, so they're going to have to do something. But I think also there's a privacy aspect to it that they can say they're controlling how the data is gathered and used. So what puts them in an amazing position to do this is they've got 6 million subscribers and even more registered users. So they've got a base that they can work on. You know, the scale that they have is second to none for that first party data. And what they've done is they're trialing, or in July they'll offer 45 new proprietary first party audience segments for ad targeting. So they're set. They've done a great job, and by 2021 they'll be absolutely sorted.
Yeah.
The issue with this one is what does everyone else do? What do people who don't have 6 million subscribers do?
Join an ad alliance.
Yeah, there's got to be something like that. And I think the next story that we've got on here is all about that.
And who's going to be the big winners? Because when we did that conversations episode specifically about this, we said this was an opportunity for publishers to reclaim that first-party data and to treat with advertisers on their terms rather than having to sort of like dance to the beat of somebody else's drum. So what does the rest of the industry think about this?
I think it depends where you start in the industry.
Mm.
You know, if you're a big publisher, then you're desperate to get your own first-party data sorted. If you're a little guy, it's like, you know, like Mark Alcott at Single Track. We talk about him a lot because he's one of the smaller publishers who's actually looked hard at programmatic.
Mm.
You've got to be wondering, well, how do I control this? How do I get the right data to deliver the right ads in this? And when the cookies go, well, Esther, you've written a lot about this. When the cookies are gone, what happens? Where does that data come from?
Yeah, I think the thing is that for a lot of smaller publishers, they've not been quite so reliant on that. You know, I mean, I know when you talk about Mark Alka is not reliant on programmatic in the same way. He's never been reliant on it. And that would be the same for a lot of smaller publishers. They're not reliant on those third-party cookies because it's never brought in, they've never had the scale to worry about that bringing in a lot of money, and they've always known it's unstable. So I think for publishers like that, there has always been this awareness that they need to rely on reader revenue, they need to rely on subscriptions or other revenue streams, or direct ads that you have a good relationship with the advertiser and the advertiser wants that context. Yeah. And you're never going to make millions like that. You're never going to pull in your huge advertise. You know, you're never going to get Nike and Coke sponsoring your stuff. But I don't think you want that either. And so in that sense, I don't think, please, if anybody wants to tweet me and correct me nicely.
I haven't looked at Twitter today. I think that the age of polite discourse on Twitter is long over.
But it's always been the medium and large publishers that have really been fanning about this because they're the ones that have built segments of their business to be reliant on it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really good piece John McCarthy did for The Drum about ad tech response to this. One of the ad tech guys basically says for smaller publishers, they will fall by the wayside, which is depressing as shit.
Yeah.
I don't think that's true. Those can take any, that doesn't just have to be you know, sharing your ads and audience data. I think it's Portugal that've got like a login alliance where this group of publishers, small, medium and large publishers, have banded together and they've just got this one login. There's lots of kind of complex things in there about who owns that data, who is using that data, and who is managing it. But again, if you're trusted publishers and you're working together and you can work those details out, that can be a very, very sensible way forward.
Every single time we talk about something like this and we say who's going to be the big winner, I can almost hear like the Jaws theme and see a shark swim with the big Google logo on it, just like carving its way through the water, because inevitably they are still the best place to take advantage of all of this.
Welcome to the Googleplex.
Okay, that was terrifying.
People are going to think I put a filter on that. I didn't. That was just your voice.
Wow.
Hey, and actually, speaking of Google and the duopoly, Facebook has bought Giphy for
We're only here for the data.
Although apparently not. This has caused lots of arguments on Twitter.
Yeah, I saw a response from someone in Facebook saying that's not true.
Okay, so the argument in favour of the idea that Facebook has bought Giphy for the data is that every time you embed a GIF from Giphy, it tracks you effectively, and it tracks everywhere you place that GIF. So it is a really good source of audience data, not necessarily purchase habits or anything like that, but it contributes to this big profile of you.
So Facebook is going to know I'm obsessed with Baby Yoda GIFs.
I think they could just listen to this podcast.
there is a wider thing here that actually Facebook is... there's certainly somebody implying that actually what is of more value is the trends in the GIFs and what people are searching for and what people think is funny or what they're using. So if everybody suddenly starts up with like GIFs from a film,
I wonder what the searches for Dominic Cummings GIFs are like this weekend.
Okay, reset the clock, everybody. Peter's made a current political event reference.
But what's important to say in this, they paid allegedly $400 million for Giphy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Giphy has no revenue at all. Zero.
Nor does WhatsApp, and you know how much they paid for that.
I know, but surely nowadays that's got to be... Surely that's the before times.
Yeah, but you plug it into something else, and all of a sudden, as Esther said, you've got this huge seam of data.
So I feel like we've been too happy talking about data here. So depressingly, just this last 48 hours or so, The Atlantic has proved that data is not enough. They've just laid off 68 people, closed a video department of 20 odd people. So data's not enough. You can be using data to grow your subs, but if coronavirus screws your ad revenues...
I think what got me about this is that The Atlantic have been heralded the last couple of months as like one of the great survivors of this, one of the people doing well, seeing success. We've heralded them a number of times for the success they've had, and it's not even that it's not enough. And I don't know which one of you put the avocado in here. Own up to it.
Okay, that was me.
I'm about to take you down.
Ooh. All right, so let me save my devil's avocado anyway. So the last couple of months we have lauded companies for right-sizing, cutting down in areas where they probably could have made some redundancies anyway in order to make sure that they were more stable going forward. I'm playing devil's avocado, not because I believe this, but because I want to have the conversation. Why is this not just right-sizing considering where they're
made? Okay, I'm about to smash your avocado onto toast with a poached egg.
Such a millennial.
We've never lauded companies cutting... People, I'll just say that now, unless I've completely been on a different podcast.
No, we said it's like always shit for those people, but we said it's the right thing to do for the companies.
I'm going to throw Matthew Ingram back at you, who said on Twitter that a revenue loss from the coronavirus is an extreme event, not a sign of a money-losing operation, which is exactly the case for this.
I mean, I think, proof if proof be need be, that you can never rely on billionaires. Even the ones who we do have decent opinions of.
I had a decent opinion of Lauren Pell Jobs.
In order to tie people over. I mean, I saw a really good tweet that was just like, as soon as you get to $999 million, you should just get a plaque that says you won capitalism and the rest should just get taken away and given to other people. Because that's all you want anyway, really.
Yeah.
I think we could probably lower that number significantly, to be honest.
The whole thing was bad timing and bad taste.
Yeah, very strange. Especially considering the fact that, like I said, all the news about them over the last couple of months has been about their subscription success, and we've always said that makes you more stable.
The coronavirus coverage has been amazing. The stuff that Eddie Young's been doing is just amazing.
All right, well, thoroughly depressed now. Should we move on to news in brief?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. News publishers are emphasising good news in order to lure back coronavirus-weary advertisers. So... I don't know if any of you saw the research from Reuters this week, basically saying that the coronavirus bump has ended and people are now thoroughly back in the news avoidance zone, just purely because they're sick of non-positive, constructive news. So, having looked for sponsors and failed, publishers are now highlighting packages of stories of civic, economic, and public recovery. Is that a solution to the news avoidance issue? Is it bollocks?
No. I think the issue with this one is they're trying to tell good stories about a bad situation. It's yeah. not like here's a little fluffy poppy stories. It's here's a positive spin on coronavirus.
Yeah, I mean, I read a heartwarming story today, actually, about a man who drove 250 miles to
Dublin. Oh, I saw this, yeah.
Yeah, to keep his child safe. It was very heartwarming. So,
yeah, it's not a crime to look after your wife and children.
No, it's not. All right, absolutely. So more of this, more of that, please, more of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Facebook has launched Facebook Shops, which is not an attempt to take on Amazon, apparently. So it's a new e-commerce service aimed at helping smaller businesses through the coronavirus crisis, and it will allow them to sell directly from the platform. Facebook does already have like a kind of marketplace system, but I think this is just going to be formalizing it a little bit more. It won't be charging sellers. Instead, the business model will be paid for ads. So expect to see more weird products in your Facebook feed soon.
There's a good piece in Folio magazine about how B2B magazines are navigating the pandemic. And it's something sort of from a friend of the podcast, Bibi Camposejo at CNEN. And she was just saying about how CNEN is the magazine for the Chemistry Society in the States. So they're talking about how they're moving some of that science coverage outside the paywall and asking for donations for it. But there's other stuff there from three or four other B2B magazines talking about with summits and webinars and PDF distribution to make up for print delays and stuff. It's just a really nice practical read.
Joe Rogan's podcast, The Joe Rogan Experience, I've never listened to it. It's going to be available exclusively on Spotify from September, including its archive. But this has ridiculously huge implications for how people actually choose where to get their podcasting. Effectively, this is probably the death of the open podcast.
I can't believe I'm going to talk about this story. I'm so furious, I don't even know how to say it.
Yeah.
So Downing Street...
couldn't get past the first two words.
I can't even say it. Has banned an open democracy lobby journalist for asking fraud, not for... Although it wouldn't surprise me if they had banned him for asking questions. They've banned James Cusick from asking questions at the daily briefings because they've said that Open Democracy is a campaigning organisation, unlike The Sun, The Mail, The Telegraph and The Express, obviously, because they're not... Oh, Robbie f***ing Savage was on the other day asking a question about football.
Yeah.
I'm going to drive 250 miles just to see.
Yeah, excellent.
The Skim is launching a digital membership model, but is not charging for it until next year. I think the publication have had memberships planned for a while to reduce their reliance on ad revenue, surprise, surprise. And if you've heard of The Skim recently, it's because they laid off 20% of staff last month.
This is a much more interesting story. The adult entertainment industry is becoming more like social network during the pandemic. The industry is moving to more individual engagement as a result of the pandemic, according to Axios. Basically, porn's free, but people will pay to interact with someone who's naked.
There's a really interesting article on Jezebel that I read about this, about how the adult entertainment industry is moving to, like, recording over Zoom, so porn recorded over Zoom, and then having that sort of interactive aspect is something that we've always sort of said, well, you know, maybe a lot of the higher newspapers are moving to that, allowing you to interact with journalism, so with journalists rather. So in a lot of ways,
where the fuck are you going with this?
Journalism's on the back foot, should be emulating the adult entertainment industry a lot more.
Definitely. Yeah. I know a couple of journalists this morning that are going to end up screwed after this Dominic Cummings story.
Can you not just see the front of the, like, the Mail Online homepage, though, and it's like news, entertainment, sport, MILFs.
So this week I spoke to Stylist Group CEO Ella Dolphin, and I began by asking her what the conversations looked like behind stylist stores as the crisis unfolded, and what they did to bring their digital subscription plans forward.
Well, luckily, we were already in planning for early April, so it was just the technology that we were working with, setting up templates from the publishing system, etc. So when it hit, it just was a mad scramble to get that done quicker. And I think the biggest change was, obviously, we stopped printing the magazine around the 23rd. Rather than translating everything from PDF, which you need when you're printing, we actually got the print team to publish straight into the digital CMS, which for them was like, well, this is a kind of new way of doing it. But we actually took out two or three publishing steps because we didn't need them.
Yeah.
Which meant that we could get it out quicker. So thankfully, we were all sort of set. I mean, it's always a bit of a mad scramble when something so dramatic happens. I'm sure it's, you know, we weren't the only business. I mean, there's no way we would have got it up and running if we weren't already 4 months down the line. So thankfully, we were.
Yeah. So the magazine itself is free to distribute and free to read and stuff. What was behind the decision to charge people for the app? Like, why not just offer it as a free download?
So we had a magazine app a few years ago before I joined, and that was free to download. It was very, very complicated to produce at the time, and that was mostly the technology and the way that you transported the print stuff into digital. It took a lot of man hours, and the workflow was particularly cumbersome. So that's why that stopped. When we brought it back, it was because people were saying, I can't get stylists. I mean, you know, we distribute 400,000 magazines, but quite often people can't get one.
It is a scramble in London.
It's a scramble. So it was based on a consumer demand. But listen, we're an ad-funded business and advertising does not cover all of our activities, even before coronavirus. So we had a plan to create it as a service, because when people are asking for something, it's not, you know, it wasn't just a byproduct, it is a service they were asking for. That we needed to just put a very reasonable subscription price on it. So that was already part of the planning, because, you know, when we say the magazine is free, it's not free. It comes with a huge cost. It's free to the consumer. But the reality is advertising can't cover all of the expansion that we want to do at Stylist.
I noticed in the app you can download, you can either pay for an issue of the magazine or you've got some quite short-term subscription options as well as the longer-term one. Is that designed kind of with the fact in mind that people will be picking it up again in the capital, hopefully in a few months?
So what you've got is you've got a subscription option, or you can buy a single issue. So quite often it might be that something on the issue is makes people want to buy it. It might be that a cover star or the treatment or the subject. So you can buy a single issue or you can subscribe.
What's the reader response been like so far?
Yeah, good. So, I mean, obviously everyone's adapting to new roles anyway, so lots of things are changing. So the question, there were a few people, you know, mostly it was through social that we'll get to hear everything saying, oh, how come it's not free if I can get the magazine for free? And we just put out the response that I've said is, you know, we're an ad-funded business, but advertising doesn't cover everything that we want to do. So we've got a, you know, very reasonable subscription price on it. And they go, okay, fine. I think once people understand, oh, listen, I think more and more consumers, particularly stylist women, they understand the mechanics behind journalism and brands, etc. So they were more, well, actually, I just want to be able to access it when I want to. The thing is with Stylist Magazine, it's not in their control. So people would rather pay to have something in their control. And then it's an absolute treat if you happen to be around when Stylist has been handed out.
Yes. And I mean, I think this is the first time Stylist has gone from just free distribution to a real kind of digital consumer revenue push. So when people do get back out in cities, like, are there things about your workflow you're going to have to, is it going to be quite a complicated workflow again to get the print and the digital product out, or are you going to kind of focus a bit more on the digital now?
No, well, that was the whole point of what we've been doing over the last few years was to uncomplicate that workflow. So when you're publishing from print to digital, that specifically, that we could automate as much of that as possible.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of upfront work in how you do the templates, etc. But we had to avoid what happened with the previous app, which was too labor intensive, too time consuming to get it done. It was almost like reproducing it all over again. So now we've smoothed that out, because obviously the volume of content that Stylist produces is huge, right? So there's only a certain amount of hours in the day. So we can't layer in another whole workflow just for the digital magazine. So that's the work that's been done, and we're really comfortable that once we've created the content, we then can publish to multiple platforms, and it's optimized for those platforms. And actually, there's a lot of automation in there now.
Yeah. Why kind of focus on the digital app? Why not sort of look at broadening out a print readership subscription? Or is that just a cost consideration?
Well, it's both. It's cost and revenue. So I could double the circulation of Stylist from a consumer point of view easily, but I'm not going to double the advertising. So it's print advertising, as we know, has been severely challenged over the years. We do very well, but we're a bit of a print unicorn, as I call it. But it's not growing. So we have to fight very hard for the revenues in print, because less of it is being produced. So it really is an economics thing. It's definitely from a consumer side, no problem at all. From the advertising revenue side, that's where it's problematic. I'd love to do it. Honestly, if the advertising was booming in print, we really would be pushing 1 million copies.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if the advertisers see the value in the digital as well, won't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's part of our circulation then, isn't it?
Yeah. You were brought onto Stylist, and they've kind of seen some quite big changes. I think it was just last year that Shortlist closed, and there was a big rebrand of the wider group. So what was your role in that, and what changes have you brought to the brand over the past few years?
So it was just over a year ago when we re-centred the whole business around the Stylist brand. And really that was because there was so much opportunity and strength in Stylist. And Shortlist was an amazing proposition, but it sort of run out of road. Whereas Stylist still had so much to develop. So it was really about focusing on strengths, and it's never an easy decision to make. But that's what we did so that we could then accelerate the opportunity around Stylist. And that's particularly, the focus has really been over the last 3 years, building our digital audience, obviously not outside of the digital magazine, but our stylist.co.uk and free web audience. And I've been particularly focused on scaling that, but with UK women, and scaling it organically through content, right? So we're not just interested in headline numbers, which are global, which are kind of, you know, bought in numbers. We don't, you know, there's no kind of clickbait. It's all our opinion. It's all through the Stylist lens. So that takes a little bit longer to scale up. But when you do, then you have a very good quality. I mean, we basically talk to, we've got 3.5 million women on the site, and they are UK stylist women. And now we're starting to see the value in that audience. So they respond very, very well to content, to advertising that we produce with our brands. So that's been one of the major focuses. And then also moving our events business, which is obviously in the freezer at the moment. Because Stylist is such an experiential, participative brand. We had one big event with Stylist Live. What we have moved to is running a calendar of events all through the year. So it might be an event for 200 people, like a live podcast, or it can be an event for 2,000 people during the day. Stylist is sort of, you know, running through the calendar, running through the seasons on every channel. Those have been the major changes.
Didn't I say the other day you launched a pre-coronavirus, you launched like a gym membership as well? It was like a gym in London.
Yeah, so we actually have had a fitness studio for the last year. And this is part of our future strategy, which is about building verticals and adjacencies on the Stylist brand in subject areas which are particularly relevant to Stylist women. So we have a vertical called Strong Women, which was a trend that we identified last year, which is more and more women moving into strength training, not just aerobics and running, or of the kind of stereotypical things that you think women might do. And we had a studio for a year where we developed a strength program for women, like lifting weights and, you know, doing all of those kind of core strength exercises. And that program has become content. So now we have a channel on the site. And but I think what you probably saw is we did a virtual event where we had a strong weekender. And we've got all of the sort of really cool fitness boutique studios, which are closed, to give us their head trainers. And we did a live Instagram over the weekend. We had like Barry's Bootcamp. And so that's probably what you saw. But we will, that's a vertical that obviously now the link between physical fitness and mental health is so intrinsic and is going to be there forevermore, that this is a really important subject area for us.
Yeah. And I suppose one of the other advantages, I mean, you were saying you were very, very focused on UK readers and UK women. Is there going to be room at some point for stylists to kind of take that out to, I don't know, US, Europe or other geographies if you're completely, well, not completely free of the print, but less reliant on the print?
So when I talked about the focus on the UK audience, that's that it was a good quality stylist audience. We publish internationally as well. And actually, America is very strong for us. So we've got a couple of million people in America, which has been growing. And then obviously we publish our content, a lot of it through the social platforms and particularly with Apple. So we do have a big digital international audience, and that's part of what we do. But the major focus for us on the commercial side has been that quality UK audience.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about Apple, actually, because I think you were an early publisher on Apple News Plus, which is their premium product. How's that going?
It's going well. I mean, we're literally just on there, so I haven't got any much to report at the moment. But it's going, as in we're literally, at the same time as us producing our app, we went on to Apple News Plus. So it's been an active April. But I think Apple has been a brilliant partner to stylists, and I think the whole concept of Apple News Plus, just rewarding publishers for time spent on content, and stylists does very, very well on Apple. It's one of those, they, you know, we're a kind of, you know, relatively compared to like New York Times or something, a much smaller brand, but they see that our content resonates with their audience, and they really respect quality journalism and content, and they really do get behind people who are doing that. And what I can say is, because our audience is only 50% Apple, 50% Android on terms of devices, as the app launched, the uptake from Apple was like 70 or 80% from Apple users. And I think that's because of Apple News Plus.
Oh, wow.
Seeing us there. So I think it, within the Apple ecosystem, it's doing very well.
Yes, I heard lots of anecdotal evidence that Apple users tend to want to pay for stuff a bit better as well, rather than Android users.
Well, that's good. We like the Apple. Are you an Apple user?
I'm not. I'm a paying Android user. I'm a rare breed. I'm quite curious about how your teams are coping, because you said that they've gone from these very print-focused workflows to suddenly having to shift into digital. And they've also presumably got this shift of having to work from home as well and deal with all the complications around that. How have they done that?
They've been absolutely brilliant. And I think working remotely is, some days it's fine, some days it's a challenge. I think the creative process is particularly challenging via Zoom or Slack or whatever, because sometimes those ideas for features are generated by how people spark off each other, and that's much harder behind a screen. So I think the creative side of the business is a bit tired, because you have to work twice as hard trying to read the room and create the features and then translate that into what the visuals are. But I don't know how they're doing it, but the end result is brilliant. I mean, this week's cover that I've signed off, it's so on point and brilliantly done that I saw it and I was like, it's quite a moving cover. And then I went off into the kitchen to make a cup of tea and I kept thinking about it. And I actually got quite emotional just thinking about it. So it's out on this week's Apple. You'll see what I mean. It talks about the power of a hug and why hugging is so important and why we might miss it. And I don't know how they're managing to do it, but somehow the work and the content they're producing is even a touch better than they were doing before. But it takes it out of people personally being behind a screen all the time. I'm sure you're feeling the same way. It, you sort of miss the buzz and the energy from other people.
Yeah, I don't know how they're doing things like, you know, covers and photo shoots and just getting, like, the content for stuff like that when you can't actually see people.
Well, do you know what? The interesting, because Stylist is actually more famous for its concept cover, and they've gone into really what the brand strength is, which is reading the room and then playing that back to people through, I mean, as they always say, pictures make you stop and then words make you stay. And they've really shown how to do that in this, like, I mean, it's an entirely digital world, isn't it? So, yes. But no, they really, really have done brilliantly. And I just think they have, like we all do, days when you go, this is totally fine, and then days when you feel, this is not okay. Been getting through it really well.
What's on your agenda in terms of getting stylists ready for the next, I don't want to say 10 years, but, you know, the next couple of years?
Yeah, next month will be.
Oh, yeah.
In the next 10 years, I think. So I'm really interested in how stylists can continue to build verticals from the main brand, and whether that's digital, experiential, you know, new product. And those verticals and adjacencies can be thematic. So what are people feeling? What are they doing? And how can we create a specific product for those areas? So building out from the main brand strength. I do feel that our events business, when it becomes more physical, and however long that takes, is going to have a new dimension to it now. And I think the power of virtual events and being able to really amplify the stuff that we do in a room with a few people to many people is super interesting. And then just actually, because of what's happened with the pandemic, you know, it's a global experience. We are seeing, to your point, that Stylist is translating globally very, very well. And that will always be in our kind of eye line of how we expand that internationally. So yes, we've got lots of plans. I mean, obviously everything got thrown up in the air a little bit this year. We've got a brand that people want, so they actually say, how do I get it? And I think if you have that, you will find your way forward, you know?
Yes, I think when you've got people, I've been guilty of stalking somebody on the train just in the hope that they put their copy down.
Listen, print is so important to us, and just for those reasons, and we've got to find a way to be able to distribute it, and also advertising is going to take a really big hit this year. So how do we fund it? How do we advertise, you know, how do we distribute it? But it will play a big role for Stylist. You know, Stylist, as I said, it's physical and experiential, and people want to participate in it. And I think the print product does all of that. So yeah, it's in the freezer, as I said. The events in the magazine are in the freezer at the moment.
Yeah, and the last thing I quite like to get your thoughts on is, you look around, and you know, I don't want to kind of trash talk any other brands, but you look around at a lot of the women's magazine market, and print and otherwise, and they seem to be really, really struggling. You know, they've got these battles with circulation. Why is Stylist, even with a huge print run, you're still really, really in demand, and you've got people literally fighting over copies? What sets Stylist apart from perhaps some of the other women's magazines in the market that has created that demand for it?
Stylist is the ability that it's positioned to reflect what women are feeling, not just what they're thinking, but how do we feel. And it's the flexibility we've got in our model, because obviously we're a fast-paced weekly, our distribution allowed us to be able to be free of the shackles of trying to sell on a, you know, dusty shelf in Tesco's, you know, so we are able to translate, and that's the whole point of it, you know, what we're translating, what women are feeling and thinking. So most often people go, oh god, yeah, that's exactly what I was just gonna say, or that's how I feel. But also, you know, it launched 10 years ago, so, you know, 10 years is 10 years, but it's not, you know, like a heritage brand, and it launched with feminism and purpose at its heart. It didn't then try to adopt it. You know, this is what Stylist does. Also, I've got a brilliant editorial team, brilliant editor-in-chief, who's just always been on point with how women are feeling. I've worked on many publishing brands, and it is the most powerful connection with the audience that I've ever seen. Constantly adapting, constantly learning, being very close to her, and that's all I can say on it. I think it's done its job brilliantly, and I think it will continue to do so. I mean, during this crisis, we're seeing, we set up a Facebook group really, the first time we announced the lockdown was coming, which is a private Facebook group. Working from home with stylists, how are you all feeling? Now we've got, 2,000 or 3,000 people in there who are commenting all the time, and we take what they say and reflect it back and use it in features so that it always feels like something that is relevant to them.
I mean, there's a podcast off the back of that as well, right?
Yeah, there's a podcast as well, yeah. So we've been phoning up people, we get the old celebrities on there, but actually just what I thought was really interesting about the podcast is it how stylists work. So the conversations that Lisa and Alexson is having with the team is how they develop features, like how they, the conversation becomes the content, and sort of being inside the stylist offices. People always love it when you could get into the office. People always used to love coming into the stylist office and just listening to the conversations that people were having, because they knew that next week they'd see that reflected on the magazine cover.
And the last question we ask all our guests is, what's the last thing you read or watched or listened to that really affected you?
Well, I think I have to watch everything that stylists recommend. But I don't know, I watch Normal People. Have you watched Normal People?
I haven't, but I've seen a lot of chatter about it.
Oh, right. So stylists started going on about it, and I thought, am I a bit too old for this? Because obviously it's about young. Oh, it was brilliant. I read the book, fabulous. Brilliant adaptation, very moving, and also just, I think the stylist said it's like the fashion film of the year. You are a little bit obsessed about what they're wearing, and we even had, so the main character in it, one of the main characters, Connell, he wears this chain, and one of our columnists actually set up an Instagram channel called Connell's Chain, because it everyone was a bit, and it had, I think it's got like 25,000 people or followers now.
So I read this last night. It's over 100,000 now.
God, is it really?
It's bonkers.
Right, so there you go. So Normal People, very moving, but also it's just one of those. I think it will always remind me of this time now. So I'll always think about lockdown and watching Normal People and getting 100,000 followers on Instagram. There you go, you just need fangirl channels and you can get 100,000 following them.
So you need to get the Media Voices daily media news roundup every single day. We've done three worth...
three worth weeks. Pretty, Sarah. We have done 3 worth weeks of yon daily.
Fossil, the open rates are terrific. We've done 3 weeks worth of issues. You can sign up on the website, voices.media. We will promise to be succinct and valuable. Top 3 or 4 stories you need to know every day, and what will make a difference to your job in the industry.
If you want to sign up for that, you can go to our website at voices.media, and there should be a nice little pop-up or a sidebar that means you can sign up. On the website, we've also got all the analysis we've written, links to all the stuff we write during the week, because we are industry professionals, despite what we sound like.
You can also find us throughout the week when we do update our social regularly. We can all be found at Media Voices Pod on Twitter, or individually. All the links are in our Twitter bio. But until next week, when we're going to be back with another guest, hopefully a slightly cheerier news roundup and much more news and views from around the media world. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye. Stay safe.
Bye.
Unless you're a government minister, then it's not a crime to look after your family.
Oh, I knew it was going to happen the second I said it.